Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, the 24th of 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Don Ringa. Today's session number is 98-1 and is titled Northwest Geology. Let's listen in.
I get great enjoyment out of telling people about the geology of the Northwest, which is very incredible, probably the geologically the most interesting area of the country. And we're going to look at, well, I call it Northwest geology, but it's kind of a, maybe that's a little bit too narrow a term. We're going to deal with some of the greater aspects of the development of the Northwest. And then maybe later on in the week, we'll look at some of this geology in detail and a little more piecemeal parts. But paint today's topic with a kind of broad brush. Geologists are fundamentally historians. The kind of things we do, we go out and look at our surroundings, the geology, whatever it happens to be, and then we try to figure out well, what it is, why it's there, hopefully maybe when it got to be there. So we're trying to unravel the history of what got things to where they are at this point in time. Now, some things we do are now kinds of geology also. I mean, when you're dealing with mass wasting or floods or perhaps earthquakes, things like this, certain kind of things are in the now sequence too. But most geologists spend most of their time looking backwards, if you will, and trying to unravel the past. And this has always been rather difficult because the further back we go, the more complicated it gets. And so it's sometimes a difficult process. I keep saying, well, we use the scientific method probably, or hopefully more than probably most scientists, because we're forced to. We gather as much information as we can and we try to explain why things are the way they are, and then perhaps try to find more information to decide, well, is this true or that true, or what's actually happened. The important thing is to gather information, and this is what has brought about some rather dramatic changes in the last 25 years or so. When I was in graduate school, the term plate tectonics wasn't even coined yet. And in fact, I took an advanced tectonics course, tectonics being the study of the great processes of the earth, and we were still arguing over why this was so and why that was so. And the main reason was that the information to support plate tectonics just really wasn't available yet. It hadn't really been yet. It's kind of startling to look back and look at the kind of simplistic ideas of plate tectonics and think that for so long you all just muddled along arguing about this and that and making the ideas more and more complicated instead of more and more simplified. So with that in mind, Bill, could you flip the light off behind you? And could somebody turn the projector on? Or all you have to do is slide that switch.
This switch?
Well, it's right close to the window there. Well, here.
On this side.
That side.
This side?
And just slide the switch forward all the way.
Oh, good work.
Thank you.
I don't know, but this switch is
I said we're going to do the big picture, so we'll start with a quick look at the world as a whole. One of the things, well, a number of things geologists realized fairly early on was that most of the younger mountain ranges, like we see here in the Western Americas, are kind of along the coastal areas, or even true here through this part of Europe. we look at the physiographic patterns. Every continent has a core area of very old rocks geologically. And again, most of the mountainous areas that you can see are strung along the boundaries. This gray or brownish color represents what we call the shields. And as you can see, every continent has a piece of some. These are geologically very old. We call ours the Canadian Shield because most of it is in Canada. So these things were somewhat puzzling. And of course, early on, there was no way to determine any age of the rocks, except to recognize that obviously some of the mountain things were somewhat younger. When we get into the U.S., more than North America, actually, we see a major chain of mountains that we kind of loosely call the Cordillera. Most of us think of it as the Rockies, but it really starts, well, in all honesty, it probably starts in Antarctica and goes up through the Andes and then up through Central America, up through the Western Americas, on up and kind of diminishes ultimately in Alaska. And then we have a much older chain of mountains in the east, in the Appalachians, the Great Plains area in between. And then younger mountains actually that sit out here along the coastal areas like the Cascades and the Coast Range in California. But a very complex pattern of mountain building from the Rockies all the way out to the west coast. So we have kind of a title for this. There's the Canadian Shield again. We call the stable part of the interior U.S. a craton. Again, the Great Plains, if you've been out past the Rockies, I'm sure most of you have, you get miles and miles and miles and miles. It's relatively flat terrain, perhaps until you come to the Missouri or Mississippi or one of those places where something has cut a little bit of a gouge in it, but mostly it's very flat terrain. From here on, that changes and it becomes certainly much more mountains. So a very, very contrasting kind of continental pattern. So this is a physiography really of the Northwest. And one of the things I want to point out is that geology determines physiography. In other words, what underlies the surface of the ground determines what the topography is going to be like. And here we see some pretty obvious things like the Snake River Plain in here. Here again are the Rockies coming up. We see this from the mountain ranges in Wyoming and can pretty much trace the edge of the Rockies on out here. Here are the Black Hills, kind of a little isolated bubble beyond the Rockies, but going out in the Great Plains. Then we see a whole series of mountain ranges. Here's the Columbia Plateau area here, and of course the Cascades coming down this way. The Basin and Range, what we call the Basin and Range down here, very spectacular pattern of mountain ranges. If you've ever crossed Nevada, especially if you go east and west across Nevada, it's just like going on a roller coaster. You go over a mountain range into a valley, over a mountain range into a valley, just time after time after time. Very interesting region. So anyway, this is all determined by what the underlying geology happens to be. So we divide our area then into provinces based on the physiography. The Columbia Basin or Columbia Plateau, here are the Rocky Mountains. Actually, we have a little bit of the Rocky Mountains right up in the very northeastern part of Washington. The Cascades here that wind down into California, the Willamette Valley, the Puget Sound area here, the Olympics. So we have a whole series of areas, again, that are determined by the underlying geology. In Washington, we're going to be dealing with a little bit off the coast. This is a little bit different physiographic map just of Washington alone. Again, you can see the obvious areas. Here's the Columbia Basin, the Cascades here, the Puget Sound here, the Olympics over here, rather distinct patterns. And again, we have names somewhat smaller now, but still taking in particular regions of the state. But again, keep in mind that the underlying geology is what determines to a large degree what the topography is like. In the early part of this century, all around, the early 20s actually, a German geographer and geologist by the name of Wegener came up with what was entitled continental drift. And Wegener's premise was that at one time, the major continents had all been part of one big landmass, and that that landmass had broken up or come apart, and the continents had moved off of where they are at the present time. Now, he based this on some fairly simplistic things. He connected a few mountain ranges. For example, you can trace the part of the Appalachians off into part of Northern Europe. Some strange patterns in terms of climate. The southern continents down here have been very obviously glaciated by large glaciers. No such thing could exist now because of climatic patterns. We find dry areas, desert kinds of patterns in places that certainly aren't deserts anymore. So he took a number of these things as an indication that if you put them all together, the patterns would match up fairly well. He wasn't well received, to make an understatement. The idea never went away. You can still find maybe a little half paragraph reference in most geology texts somewhere along the line, but it was pretty largely poo-pooed because nobody would believe that the continents really had any way of moving, that they couldn't drift along through solid rock. And so there was, beyond this, not a whole lot of support. There are some interesting patterns in terms of distribution of animals and fossils. Again, there are certain fossils that show up in different continents that would suggest they had one time been connected. Some of the distribution of animals certainly gives some implication that there must have been some way for them to migrate back and forth. Most of these were explained in other ways. Maybe they drifted in. I can't imagine a possum hanging on the tree and drifting across the ocean too very far. Or that there were land bridges, like you see up here on the upper right, where they could migrate from one place to another. Land bridges are still looked at in some cases, or island hopping, where there were islands that the different animals could bounce along from one to the other, or you could believe in continental drift. But anyway, the information got more and more complicated as geologists got more and more information, and that's probably always the sign of bad ideas. Wegener had some very interesting conclusions, or made some very interesting conclusions. He said that about 200 million years ago, all the continents were connected in this one big landmass, and that they gradually began to break apart. And as we see it now, they're in the present position where we see them. And as it's turned out over the years, Wegener was so incredibly right, it's kind of startling. Very little of his sequence or patterns have been changed by modern information. The how and why for, wherefore of it all has certainly changed, but Wegener turned out to have been a real prophet. Whoa, the earth is still on its side. Yeah. Everybody lean off to the left. Well, let's skip this one for a second. Hope this one came out right. Let me go back just a second. Not too long, well, actually in the late 50s, the scientific community got together for an international geophysical year, and they began to collect droves of information about the Earth. And one of the things they did was make some very extensive surveys of the ocean floor. And one thing that came out that was kind of startling was that there's a major pattern of undersea mountain ranges that we call the mid-ocean ridges. This is the mid-Atlantic ridge. This is, again, obviously Africa and South America. And I can't believe that somebody has some marks to put one in the wrong way. But anyway, this is one of the patterns that showed up. And in a way, the Earth looks kind of like a baseball with all the stitches and things being the ridge and rift system. This is the so-called East Pacific Rise, which isn't nearly as spectacular as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, but it comes up the Eastern Pacific. Literally hundreds of undersea volcanoes, especially here in the western part of the Pacific, major deep ocean trenches that you see in here along the Aleutians and all the way down the Pacific along Japan and the Philippines and on down in New Zealand and over here under the Indonesian countries. So Rager made a kind of prophetic statement before he died. Actually, he was killed exploring in Greenland. But he said that if Continental Drift turned out to be true, that the proof of it would probably come from the ocean floor, because the ocean floor at that time was almost completely unexplored. It's still an area that we probably know a whole lot more about the surface of the moon and the surface of Mars probably than we do on the ocean floor, because they've been photographed. You can't do that on the ocean floor. So anyway, it turns out he was probably right. One of the proofs of the pudding, of course, would be able to match some of the geology from place to place. In other words, if it's true, then we ought to be able to read the newspaper from boundary to boundary in order to make the connection. And this is one of the things that finally came out. This was kind of an interesting aspect of the study. I remember when the first geologic groups went out to take a look at the coast of South America and Africa, they set out to disprove continental drift. And this is not the scientific way, but as a group, they felt that this was not a valid idea. They were going to look at the geology and prove for once and for all that, in fact, it didn't work. This is what they came up with, that the geology matches almost perfectly from coast to coast. The type of rocks, the age of the rocks, they came back finally saying, well, it seemed almost impossible then that Africa and South America were not connected at one time. So the whole process was turned around. Geologists who have worked different parts of the world, and North America is probably one of the best examples, began to find areas geologically that just simply didn't belong. We have a number here in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, all the way down into California. They find little patches of geology that just simply do not fit anything that's around them. And geologists began to call this suspect terrain. They suspected that it didn't belong there, but they didn't really know why. And oftentimes the matches would be off somewhere else, like here's a little part of Idaho that's very much like part of the Alaskan Peninsula, or coastal areas that match up more with things over in Asia. So these were ideas that were very difficult to handle. Well, then along came the idea that looking at the mid-ocean ridges, some geologists came up with the thought that the ocean ridges represent places where the actual ocean floor was being torn apart. And as it moved apart, it was being filled in by younger volcanic rock. So this was called what they call seafloor spreading. that the ocean floor was, in a sense, like a big conveyor belt. And in the places where the rifted ridge systems were, the ocean floor was being torn apart. In the places where the big trenches were, the ocean floor was actually being pulled down, or we call it subducted, underneath the edge of the continent. In the 60s, a survey was done off the west coast. Here's the mouth of the Columbia and the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And they mapped some of the patterns, electromagnetic patterns of the rocks on the ocean floor, and they came up with this funny strike pattern, and nobody could figure out what it was. It sat around for a year or two, and finally it was given to a grad student, and they came up with the idea that maybe this was an example then of a support of seafloor spreading. And the idea being that as rocks are formed on this ridge and rift system, they'll take on the magnetic fingerprint of whatever the Earth's magnetic field happens to be at that time. Now, the Earth's magnetic field over the years has undergone reversals. The north magnetic pole becomes the south magnetic pole, and back and forth. Now, the Earth had flip-flopped, and we don't fully understand all the whys and wherefores of what brings this about, but it's a fact that it has happened. The magnetic fields are probably caused by movements in the liquid part of the Earth's core. And with a fluid system, why physicists say, well, this is something that probably happens, and they give deep explanations that I don't understand. But nevertheless, the magnetic fields have flip-flopped. But each time it happens, then the rocks, the new basaltic rocks on the ocean floor take on whatever that magnetic fingerprint happens to be. In other words, the magnetic granules in the rock are aligned either north or south, depending on whatever the field happens to be. So they take on this little fingerprint. So as they migrate away from the places where the new rocks are being formed, each side then carries an identical fingerprint of the magnetic fields. And this is what they said was causing the strikes. So their interpretation was, okay, here's the present day center of the ridge and rift system where you see the red. On either side then there are lines that match the magnetic stripes as the ridge and rift system is pulled apart. So this was a way then of supporting the idea of seafloor spreading. So all this is that original map with colors added. No proof yet. I mean, it's still an idea, a rather tantalizing one, but still an idea. So they went from there to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge south of Iceland and did the same kind of survey and came up with the same kind of strike pattern there, which certainly supported the idea that the ocean floor was gradually growing. Now, if the ocean has always been stable, as some people believed, in other words, that continents have always been where they are and the ocean has always been where it is, and then it should have accumulated layers of rock, of sediment, if you will, over the years, with the very oldest stuff down the bottom and up at the top, younger layers, and a pretty uniform pattern. It should tell us really the history of the Earth. If seafloor spreading was correct, then the further one gets away from the ridge and rift system, we should find older rocks as one gets closer and closer to the current ridge and rift system. Those older rocks should disappear and the rock layer should become younger and younger. And this would support the pattern then that this was a spreading system. In order to prove this, then, what was needed was to go out and drill a hole down through the ocean floor and encounter one of these layers, let's say this one right here, obtain a sample of that rock layer, and then date it geologically, come over here, drill a hole down here where one thought the same rock layer ought to exist, and get a sample of this and see if they match. Well, that's what turned out. The ocean floor, geologically, is highly simplistic. It has layers of basaltic rock in here. This is the lava rock like you see all over the state of Washington, which most people call lava, but correctly is basalt. On top of that is a whole complex series of what we call pillow lavas, where the lavas have oozed out on the ocean floor, and they tend to roll up or ball up into a kind of a spherical mass. And then, of course, there are some sediments usually on top of that, how much depending on where it happens to be. But so far, the oldest rocks found on the ocean floor are only about, well, last I heard around number about 200 million years old. The Earth currently is dated at about 4.5 billion years old. So geologically, the ocean floor is very young. These are pillow lavas. These are over in the Olympics. So this is part of an old ocean floor now that's been pushed up and incorporated into the Olympic Mountains. And this is a pretty typical ocean floor pillow deposit. Anyway, after drilling a number of holes on the ocean floor and patterns back and forth, the geologist came up with this kind of a pattern in terms of what the ocean floor was like. The red now is the current ridge and rift system, and as one goes to the lavender colors, the rocks are progressively older and older. So as you can see with the Mid-Atlantic Ridge here, the rocks have been pulling apart for quite a while. Here's the Pacific, where the movement is even greater and the patterns are even wider. And it provided a way to get some idea of how fast the movement was going on, how fast were the seafloors actually spreading. So this was a very major step in supporting the idea of seafloor spreading. Now all this really kind of ignored the continents where we are. It really dealt more with the ocean floor. Well, in the same time, the U.S. in particular had set up a whole series of seismograph stations around the world to monitor mostly atomic bomb testing. They were curious about what the Russians were doing, and you can detect explosions just like you can detect earthquakes. So they were measuring earthquakes, but they were also measuring explosions, and they began to plot the earthquake patterns on the world map, and it became pretty obvious that there are some rather striking patterns to it. The major deep earthquakes occur along the edge of the continents. That's the one you see here in red, and only along the edge of the continents. And then, of course, there are lots of earthquakes that occur in sort of well-defined patterns. And there are random ones, obviously, but most of the earthquakes occur in fairly predictable areas. So it was decided then that this had to be the boundary, or these had to be the boundaries of the crustal plates. And it was actually these plates that were moving. And in the places where the plates were running into each other, the so-called subduction areas, these were places that generated the most earthquakes, the biggest earthquakes, the deepest earthquakes. Places where the ridges were pulling apart were active, but not very much so. The earthquakes were relatively shallow and generally fairly mild, and that's the one you can see in blue. So the Pacific especially is encircled by a major complex of earthquakes, and of course, year in and year out, we hear major earthquakes that occur through those patterns. So those boundaries then became the plate boundaries, and it was possible then to figure out which direction those plates were moving. The Pacific plate is moving generally kind of to the north and west. The North American plate, as we call it, is moving pretty much westward. A small plate in here off the coast of South America is moving toward South America. And obviously, when one part of a plate's going in one direction, it has to run into something going the other direction. So there are boundaries where the plates run into each other. There are boundaries where they pull apart. The rate of movement is about like your fingernails grow. Some a little faster than others. There are places where the movement might be maybe 8 or 10 centimeters a year, and most of the time it's more like perhaps a couple of centimeters a year. But now, especially with some of the modern satellite techniques and mobile positioning and things like that, where the rates of movement are much more precisely measured and patterns are really very, very precise. So, in 100 years, the Earth is going to change somewhat. The gray shows where the various plate segments are likely to be 100 years from now. Australia is moving northward. North and South America are moving predominantly westward. The Mediterranean is going to get kind of crunched in here. So the directions are really fairly predictable. There are three kinds of what we call collision boundaries. There are places where the ridge and rest system is the pull apart boundary. This is where the plates are being torn apart and new ocean floor is being formed. But also we have places like this, for instance, in the Western Pacific, in Japan, the Philippines, the Indonesian islands. The oceanic plate is going along and it's sliding under, kind of under the edge of the continent, but some distance away from the main continental body. When that happens, the rocks begin to heat up and melt. When they melt, they expand. When they expand, we get volcanoes. And so we have the volcanic islands like Japan and the Philippines and the Indonesian islands and so forth. We call this an island arc system. The Aleutians are the same kind of thing. We have places where the edge of one plate is actually the edge of the continent. And this would be typical of South America or our part of North America, where again the oceanic plate is going down, rocks melt, they come up right on the edge of the continent. So we see places like the Andes and the Cascades and so on. Or we have places where two plate segments now have overrun whatever ocean might have existed between them, and they're starting to run into each other. So two plate boundaries or plate segments are impacting each other, and this is typical of the Himalayas, where India in particular been pushed up into the southern part of Asia, and in the process of pushed up the Himalayas, and then to some degree the Alps and those mountains. So these are typical collision boundaries. We also find really a fifth kind of boundary, if you will, in places where the plates are sliding along past each other. And this is typical of the San Andreas system in California. The San Andreas Fault is part of a plate boundary, and the two plates there are literally sliding along side by side. They're impacting, but they're more skidding along edge to edge. So that's another kind of boundary. And they show up a few places in the world, but the San Andreas certainly is the best known. One thing that you have to keep in mind is that this is not a static system. I mean, that everything isn't kind of sitting still like a conveyor belt running in place. The plates are actually moving. What we see in the Western Americas is that at one time there was a fairly large piece of ocean floor out here, and the North American plate has continually moved over that piece, and gradually the old plate boundary that was here has gone into the edge of Western America. And now we find the connection here, what's left of it, comes up here into the Gulf of California. We see the translation between this, which is the old East Pacific Rise, which is the pole park boundary, and the next segment up here that we call the Juan de Fuca area, but the connector is the San Andreas Fault and some of the fault systems that occur in that part of California. So it's not a static system. A lot of what was once part of the Pacific Ocean floor has really disappeared under Western America. Again, looking at the age of the rocks, we see the same kind of pattern. This is just simply a closer look at the diagram I showed you earlier. Here's the East Pacific Rise, the spreading boundary. It disappears up here into the along Baja California. The San Andreas comes up here and then comes off, and then we see what we call the Juan de Fuca Ridge that runs up this way. Understanding some of the offsets and minor faulting patterns is a little bit more complicated in places. When you look at the ridge and rift system, it's always crosscut by faults that go pretty much at right angles to the trend of the ridge. And we think these are probably the result of the fact that the plate is moving on a spherical body, a spherical mass, if you will, and all parts of the plate are not able to move equally. You just simply can't take a whole bunch of plates, and I don't know, there's probably about seven or eight, nine major plates and a whole bunch of little smaller plate segments. But moving them around on something that's spherical, they have to move with somewhat unequal patterns. And so the accommodations seem to come oftentimes in faulting like this that cross-cuts the boundaries. Well, one upshot of this, as geologists have finally unraveled the story in Western America, is that Western America is made almost entirely of bits and pieces that have come in from somewhere else. This is one of the later diagrams, and each one of these letter symbols represents a certain segment or a certain terrain, if you will. And we find that all the way from almost to Mexico, clear up into Alaska, the western U.S. is made of bits and pieces of other continents, if you will, islands. It's hard to know sometimes exactly what they were, but it's simply a patchwork quilt of bits and pieces that have been tacked on as the North American plate has moved this way. It's gradually picked up these things that were once part of the Pacific Ocean floor, or perhaps continents in themselves, or small micro islands, or wherever they happen to be. So the old idea of suspect terrain has really been borne out. Going a little far astray, the Hawaiian Islands were a long time puzzle, and plate tectonics have given a pretty good understanding of what's going on here. The North American plate, of course, is moving westward, but the Pacific plate is also moving, as you saw earlier, in a kind of northwesterly direction. And the Hawaiian Islands are part of what we look at as call it a hot spot. It's a place where there's a continual upsurge of heat and molten rock coming up out of the interior of the earth. And as it does so, the Pacific plate is migrating across the top of that hotspot. The hotspot is fixed. It's actually below the level of the plate. The plates are 25, 30 miles thick, the depth thickness varies from place to place, but it's really a fairly thin skin of rigid rock, and then it moves along rock that's partially molten. The very deep interior of the Earth is molten, but the greater part of the Earth's interior is pliable, if you will. You might think of it being like silly putty or something like this. But anyway, as that plate segment moves along, the hot spot keeps breaking through the top of it. But as the plate moves, then the rocks that are formed are carried further and further westward as the plate continues to move. So we find that Hawaiian Islands, the current activity is way down here on Hawaii at the very eastern end of the chain. But we follow a whole series of volcanic islands all the way out to, I think Midway is the last positive remnant. And that is a funny change. Somewhere along here, the plate has changed direction for whatever reason. One kind of embarrassing thing about plate tectonics is that there are still lots of arguments over what makes it go. The fact that it's happening is pretty much given. You simply can't refute the measurements and things that indicate, but what makes it go is still up for argument, because whatever happens is going on way down below the Earth's surface where we don't see it. But anyway, here's this whole volcanic chain now that is finally going up here and ultimately disappears kind of into the Aleutian Trench. So again, a pretty decent explanation for the origin of the Hawaiian Islands and that chain of volcanic islands. And there are, about three other chained volcanic islands in the Pacific that show pretty much the same pattern. In other words, that they go out like this and then change direction.
Are there other hot spots like that?
Yeah, there are several others. Yellowstone has looked at it being a possibility. Some of the ones in, there are a couple in the Pacific or in the Atlantic that are probably hotspots. This is probably the most spectacular one because it is well away from the plate boundaries and certainly a lot more active than those. But there are some others that aren't quite as distinctive. Getting a little closer to home, we have, of course, volcanic mountains, and more about that later in the week, that are, again, part of this, of that boundary system. Typically, a chain of volcanoes will show up about 100 to 150 miles from the subduction zone, and so we have a fairly long chain of volcanoes. This was taken before Mount St. Helens lost their head. This is good in the foreground and Rainier, or Adams, I should say, and Mount St. Helens here, but she doesn't look like that anymore. We have mountains like much of the Rockies, especially the Eastern Rockies, that are very obviously folded. These are old ocean floor sediments. Limestones and sandstones and shales and things that contain lots of marine fossils and everything. So here's a case where the rock materials have just simply been pushed up into wrinkles, if you will. And you can see rather nicely some of the patterns here in the rocks that show the folding. When we look at our part of the Northwest, this is what we call the Idaho batholith. Here's the Snake River Plain, and as I said, Yellowstone Park over here is thought to be a hot spot, and that much of the volcanic stuff that we see all the way across Idaho and over into Oregon is the result of that plate moving across the hot spot and gradually migrating to its present position in Yellowstone. It's not quite that simplistic, but the idea nevertheless. So again, here are the Cascades, which are dominantly volcanic all the way down the Columbia Basin into here. Again, this is a little piece of the Rockies sitting up here in northeastern Washington. Geologically, the map goes from being fairly simple to rather messy, complicated. Here are the Rockies with a rather complex pattern of rocks of different ages. And then the North Cascades, very much the same way. But from here on down, volcanic stuff covers over everything. So everything we see in here is geologically relatively young because the volcanic activity is much more recent, and so it serves as a veneer over whatever rock might be underneath. But in the North Cascade, we see very much of the older rock, and so what you see around here is that older stuff, and again, geologically, it's pretty ugly. So we have the Juan de Fuca plate here, and the ridge like this. The ridge marks the place where the plates are pulling apart. So the little ridge or plate here is going predominantly eastward. The North American plate is running westward, and somewhere under here, the oceanic plate is going down under, and then we see the pattern of volcanoes coming down through the Cascades. So probably a neighborhood of maybe 100 million years ago, give or take a little bit, what we see as Washington probably didn't exist. The boundary of the North American continent was somewhere probably along the Washington, Oregon boundary, Idaho boundary over here. And there were some volcanoes that were active off the coastline, very much like the volcanoes that we see in the Japanese islands now. So that was a fairly typical subduction zone. But as the plate has continued to move, gradually it has overrun those volcanic islands, and they've been incorporated then into parts of, a little more of the eastern part of Washington, if you will. And at the same time then, there were old volcanic islands or perhaps small pieces of continental segments that existed here off the coastline. And gradually those have been incorporated into Washington, and we find all these little segments now. And then of course the last major activity was the eruption of the Columbia River basalts, which again made kind of a veneer along with the other volcanic stuff that covers up a lot of the older geology, so it's not been possible to figure out what's going on or what went on. Now, a couple of things that we see geologically. A lot of rock that's formed in the upper part of the Earth's crust is formed by the intrusion of what we call large plutons. I'll use the term granite kind of loosely because most of them are granite. But this is a fairly durable rock, but these are formed by the crystallization, or if you want, the rocks have been melted and they recrystallize and they make a massive amount of granite, but always well down below the Earth's surface, maybe 3, 4, 5 miles. When we see them, as we do around here quite often, they are there because everything that once covered them up has been removed by erosion. So granite is a rock that forms well down below the Earth's surface. When we see it on top of the ground, it's because erosion has removed everything that once covered it up, and now we begin to see the segments of that rock. So this means then probably that there's been a fair bit of uplift or pushing up of the Earth's crust in order for the erosion to occur, to actually move a few miles of rock material. Go back here just a second. Along with this, as these massive rocks tend to cool and harden, they also tend to alter the rocks around them. The heat and pressure will change rocks that were already there into something else, and we call it metamorphic rock. And so that's a pretty common rock material when you drive around parts of the Cascades or even around here. Look at some of the rocks up around the Arc or different places where they've done rock work, and you'll find stuff like this where the rocks show a very distinctly banded pattern, and those are metamorphic rocks. Those are change rocks. Pretty common stuff in the hills around here. I think I took this one down at Fields Point, where the road is cut on down into the parking area. But again, a very common rock material. So granites and these kind of metamorphic rocks are pretty typical of what we see around here. Well, as the story that finally unraveled, again, what the geologists now see in Washington is that there are many, many little fragments of plate segments that have gradually been plastered on to the western part of the U.S. and Washington included. Each one of these has a name as what geologists call a separate terrain. Oftentimes they're bounded by faults, because as these things come in, as the plates move along and encounter one of these segments, it's a grinding collision and usually marked with a fairly sharp boundary. So we have a whole complex series of these little segments here. Most of this rock here that shows up as kind of a speckled pattern are some of the large intrusions, and this happens to be one of the major ones is right here. This is actually called the Railroad Creek Pluton, which is, we see just up the way here. Along with this has come a lot of the formation of minerals. We think that at one time the minerals that constitute the ore deposit here were probably minerals that were formed on the ocean floor. I don't know if you follow the newspapers and things at all, but periodically one of the newspapers will do an article about the Juan de Fuca Ridge and the fact that they've found places on the ridge where they have what they call black smokers. Well, these black smokers are places where high temperature fluids are coming up out of the Earth's interior along the ridge and rift system, and they carry a lot of mineral material, and oftentimes that will crystallize to form what we would look at as being valuable minerals right around the smokers. Well, when those parts of the ocean floor end up being subducted and reconstituted like they have around here, why oftentimes those will end up as a useful ore body. And so we find places like Holden where we think now this probably was an old plate segment, but it's gotten its ore mineralization probably from something that was once on the ocean floor. Going back to the idea of erosion, when you look at the North Cascades are spectacularly rugged. People call them the Alps of the U.S., and that's probably pretty sound. But it's there, well, for two reasons. One, the rocks are very hard and durable. There are lots of the metamorphic rocks that are very hard, the granitic rocks that are very durable. They've been chopped up by glaciers and streams. And so it's a very rough, jagged kind of pattern with places like Mount Baker volcanoes kind of perched up on the top. But a very spectacular rough terrain. And that's what makes the scenery around here. Lots of very nice, hard, durable rocks. slide that back just so the fan runs and then light it off. Would you leave the fan on, just let it kind of cool down a little? That's the thing. So that's probably more than you ever wanted to know about. Like I say, trying to deal with the complex geology of this area is something that's, well, probably dull as can be, and I don't claim to be a great expert on all the whys and wherefores of the different terrains and plate segments and that sort of thing. So throughout the week, we're going to look more at little individual areas and some of the particular aspects of what's going on, things that are a lot more visible perhaps than what we see as you look up the mountains. But I did want to start with at least giving you some idea of how we think the West got to be the way it is. Far too simplified probably, but kind of the story. Yes?
There are no oil deposits in this great Northwest?
They have found oil in the Olympics, well, on the south end of the Olympics. I don't know about, probably been 35 years ago now, there was a fairly successful well drilled and it produced rather high quality oil, but they were never able to offset it, and it didn't last very long, so there is a little bit of, obviously there is some, and the oil companies would like to do some offshore drilling. I think they drilled one or two wells offshore, but in the very western part of Washington, in the Olympics and off the coastal area, are about the only places where there really are good oceanic sedimentary rocks that would likely produce oil. Now they've also drilled in the Columbia Basin where there are some big folds, and they believe that the basaltic rocks covered over some oceanic sediments, and they did get gas out of them, but again, not commercial quantities. So at this point, I guess the answer would be yes and no. There are certainly signs that there is some oil, but it's, so far, nobody's had any luck in finding it commercially.
I have a question that really was not related to this. I just wondered what your opinion was. The book Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky, he talks about Venus making a pass in close to the Earth and putting it 23 degrees off its axis. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, is he one that feels the Earth is actually has flip-flopped? It seems to me that's his story, that he feels the Earth's axis actually did completely tumble over once. I don't think the idea of the Earth axis turning is very well accepted, because most scientists feel that once the Earth established its rotational pattern, that it wasn't going to change.
Well, he talks about tropical plants in Siberia and things.
Yeah. And you know, some of that is the result of plate tectonics, the fact that the plates have moved, and there are some odd things there. You know, there are certainly climatic patterns that are decidedly out of whack, and sometimes plate tectonics doesn't provide a perfect answer. And some of the climatologists say, well, there appear to be times when our climate has been remarkably different than a lot more so-called global warming than perhaps we see now. So I think his idea of the Earth's axis flopping is not very well accepted. But like a lot of things geologically, there's not a great deal of any way to prove some of these ideas. So
I found this extremely interesting. It's something I knew a little bit about it not really enough to form any opinions or anything, but I've always been interested in how things happen in the past.
Yeah. Well, one problem theologically is most things happen so slow and slowly that we get tied up and we drop millions of years, like government agency drops millions of dollars, and sometimes it's a little disconcerting to people who have a lifespan of 80 or 90 years that all of a sudden a million years becomes a pretty casual term. It could be a little distressing.
The volcanoes that you showed in the one slide started under the ocean, and as the two plates...
No, these are strictly continental in origin. They've all formed on the continents, but they're... the volcanoes that are, as we call seamounts on the ocean floor, form mostly on the ridge systems. Most of them are never probably see the light of day. Some do. There are lots of volcanic islands, again, in the Western Pacific, but obviously the Hawaiian Islands, but also the Samoan Islands, and all those are also volcanic. But those volcanoes have grown from the ocean floor up. But these are strictly land-based. They've never been on the ocean.
On your slide on continental drift, where they can project out 100 years.
Oh, 100 years.
I thought it was awfully but even that, going back to earlier times when they did celestial navigation and established the northern and the eastern we are still using now, is there any evidence that
Well, of course, again, when you go further back in time, you look at some of the ideas of where the continents were like, say, 500 or 600 million years ago, and they're just little bits and pieces here and there, because as we go back in geologic time, getting information gets harder and harder. The rocks, older rocks get buried, or they've been changed or altered some way. You start with a book pile with the first one on the bottom of the pile, and pretty soon you have a big high pile, and you're reading the top page. And so some of that information is kind of hard, hard to come by. We also know, like with the Hawaiian chain, that the direction of movements have changed over time, and I think the change of direction there is only about 50 million years old, so it's a little bit of a supposition to say, well, in 100 million years they're going to precisely be here, because things may change a little. We won't worry about it. I won't worry about it. but yeah, it's even on the East Coast now, it's recognized that much of the East Coast is made up of bits and pieces of other areas. There's a rather substantial piece of Africa that's part of the East Coast, and so there are several major slivers in there that are rocks that are totally out of context and really belong to somebody else, or should have belonged to somebody else. And the patterns have changed. Obviously, at one time, the North American continent was headed east. At the time, those pieces were added on, and then for whatever reason, it's changed about 180 degrees, and now it's headed west, and has been for quite a while. So a lot of things about the plate tectonics that we certainly don't understand. The now kind of things are measurable and determinable, but the older ones get to be harder and harder.
What's the age of the world estimated?
The age of the world?
Yeah.
About 4.5 billion.
4.5 billion.
The oldest rocks that have been found are right at 4 billion, up in the Canadian Shield area, and some of the Scandinavian Shield. But there's a kind of a fudge factor in there, because most geologists think, well, those are on top of the ground, were found pretty much on the surface, and likely there are older rocks down below somewhere. And it goes into dating some of the other things in our solar system too that fall into that age bracket. So that's the current thought. That's probably about 4.5 billion. Well, thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Thank you.